We used to take a whole week on the book of Job. This is in earlier years when we had a man more expert than myself teaching it. But even though he was more expert than myself and a good teacher, it got to drag a little bit. I mean, think about it. This meant 15 hours on the book of Job. Now, you've just read through the book over the weekend, and therefore you're somewhat familiar with the material. As you know, there's a lot of repetition in it. At least some of the same thoughts are repeated over and over again. This is particularly true in the debate between Job and his three friends, and also in much of what Elihu says later on in the book. And this repetition tends to make it a little... It tends to make it drag a little bit if we go verse by verse through the whole book, because after a while we're just hearing the same things again. There's not too much more to comment on except, you know, academic observance of different, you know, poetic literary devices that are found in Hebrew poetry, which is what this book is made up of. Those things are not the kinds of things we want to concentrate on in this school, although we do want you to have some familiarity with the principles of understanding Hebrew poetry. We don't want to dwell so deeply upon them that we lose the message of the book altogether. It is possible to get so deeply entrenched in this book that you lose sight of its general flow. And so what we have done, and this may be going the opposite direction to a fault, we've decided that instead of covering the book of Job in 15 hours, that is in 10 sessions, we're going to start covering it in only a few sessions, and not attempt to take it verse by verse. That is why I had you read the material beforehand, so that you have read all the verses, and we will go through and summarize a great deal. We will have three lectures, at least that's what's planned. It's possible we may spill over into four, but we will just take certain things that we want to observe out of the book, and not try to cover every verse. Now, it may be that you'd like to have a verse-by-verse treatment. If so, you're welcome to get the tapes out of our library, the tapes on Job, or by John Evans. And he's a very good teacher. But unless you're very, very interested in all the details of Job, you may find it burdensome to go through the book in that manner. Anyway, that's not what we're going to do in this school this week. We're going to do lectures. Today we'll have an introductory lecture, and also we want to cover today, if possible, those, what we could call the historic passages, the passages that deal with the biographical information, the historic events. As you know, most of the book of Job is not made up of telling a story at all, but of recording a conversation or debate. And the vast majority of the chapters are taken up with these discourses by Job and his friends and Elihu and God. And therefore, the story does not move forward through the vast majority of the chapters. Out of 42 chapters, only 2.5 tell the story, and almost 39.5 chapters give us these discourses. So what I want to cover today is a brief introduction to the book in general, and also these historic portions, so that we'll have the story before us, and understand, I hope, what took place. And then in the future lectures on the subject, we will hope to cover the speeches as adequately as possible in the time allotted. Now, the author of the book of Job is not given to us. We aren't told who wrote it. The book is anonymous. It is possible that Job wrote the book, although there's no reason to believe that he did. It apparently was written by a prophet of sorts. I say of sorts, meaning that if, for instance, Job was the author, he was not principally a prophet, but he must have had some prophetic insight, because chapters 1 and 2 in particular tell of events that happened in the heavenlies, conversations between God and the devil, things that no human observer would be privy to unless God revealed it. Everything on chapter 2 could have been witnessed and recorded by an observer, but chapters 1 and 2 record the secret counsels which could only be known to a writer if God revealed them. Therefore, we have to say that the person who wrote the book of Job received revelations from God, and therefore we call him a prophet. That is why the book is in the Bible. We know that there are many books of history, many books of Hebrew poetry that have been written, that were written in Old Testament times, that are not included in our Bible. But the reason that we have the books we do is because it is believed that prophetic authority lies behind the books that are included. That is, that the persons who wrote were not just giving us good samples of Hebrew poetry or wisdom literature, but they were writing under inspiration. And the author gives evidence of having inspiration from God, because he knows what God and Satan talked about at the beginning of the story. Now, I'd mentioned wisdom literature. We haven't perhaps said very much about this. Wisdom literature is a type of literature that is found in the Old Testament for the most part. Some of the Psalms contain it. The book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes certainly belong to this class of literature. Some of the material in the prophets also contains wisdom literature. So we're talking about Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, some of the material in the prophets, some of the Psalms, and a few passages even in the historical portions. There are times when certain proverbs are quoted by in the books of Kings or the books of Samuel, even in Judges, where Gideon's son tells the fable of the trees seeking a king. This would be a good example, I think, of wisdom literature among the Jews. Wisdom literature represented the philosophizing of the wise men of Israel. Remember that there were three ways that ancient Israelites sought to know the will of God. There was the law of God, which was written, and which was in the custody of the priests, so that people could go to the priests, or at some times in history, the judges, to learn what the law of God said that they should do, and to learn the will of God this way. There was also the prophets. The prophets would get a word from the Lord for a current situation. They'd get an oracle from God. Then there were wise men. And the wise men were men of exceptional personal insight. They did not necessarily experience what would be called inspiration in every case, but they had exceptional wisdom, and it was considered that wisdom itself is something that God gives a man. When we've talked about divine guidance in the past, although it's been a long time and you may not recall, I suggested that these three ways that God's will was discerned in the Old Testament are really still available to us. The written word is the first place we should go for information. There is also, of course, revealed guidance, which God may give us through prophets or dreams or visions or other means that are supernatural. And then there is, I guess we could call it common sense, wisdom. We have to remember that rational thinking is a gift that God gave to man that he has not given to the other animals. And it is therefore a gift of God for discerning right courses and wise choices. And it should not be thought to be an evil thing or a carnal thing to rely to some extent on common sense for making decisions. Now, it's true that the Bible says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding in Proverbs 3:5. But your own understanding, of course, cannot be trusted finally. But in the absence of some revealed word from God, common sense or the best that human wisdom can produce, enlightened by the principles of God, enlightened by a renewed mind that a Christian has, is not altogether unworthy means of guidance. In fact, probably most of the decisions we make on the basis of common sense. If you think of all the decisions you make in a day, and I mean every decision, we probably make hundreds of decisions every day of a very minor sort. Most of them we don't hold out for getting a word from God about it. We make decisions instantly in some cases, just from wisdom. Well, the Jews got insight from God that way too. And the wise men of Israel, along with the priests who carried the law, and the prophets who gave current insights, the wise men were those who spoke for God also. Some of them, however, were wicked. We know that Ahithophel was one of the wise men under David's administration, but he became a traitor and counseled against David to his son Absalom. So wise men can be corrupted as well. But a godly wise man who's schooled in the principles of God's word, often can a counselor can often be a means of discerning the will of God for one's life. The book of Proverbs, the book of Ecclesiastes obviously represent some of this kind of counsel from a wise man, from Solomon, who of all the wise men was considered to be the very wisest. The book of Job also belongs to this class of literature, the wisdom literature of Israel. Job and his counselors were what would be called wise men. But their wisdom is human wisdom. It is somewhat enlightened by their knowledge of God, but it is limited because they don't know enough about God. Realize that Job, as it would appear, lived prior to the time that God had given any written revelation to man. Now, we can't prove that, but the evidence within the book would suggest that the story occurred very early in biblical history, probably in what we call the period of the patriarchs, that being the days of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, prior to the giving of the law, prior to the time of Moses. I say that because there's not any reference to God's law in the entire book. There is no reference, for example, when Job is said to be, you know, suffering for his wickedness, when he isn't. Job doesn't make any reference, for instance, to the story of Joseph as a precedent for a man who is godly and has suffered horrible things. Job's protest throughout his speeches is that God sometimes allows righteous people to suffer. He gives no examples from the stories in our Bible. He was probably not familiar with the stories of the Old Testament. He lived without that kind of divine revelation. Yes?
What about the knowledge of sacrifices and stuff in verse 5?
Knowledge of sacrifices all the way back to Adam and Eve. Yeah, all people knew about sacrifices. Yeah, I think when Abel offered a lamb, that was as a sin offering. Way back in the days of Cain and Abel. I think that sacrificial systems of sorts had been known from earliest times because Abel offered sacrifices, Noah offered sacrifices. These were hundreds of years before the law was given. The thing that the law did was prescribe certain means by which God could be sacrificed to rightfully without offending him. But people offered sacrifices for a long time before Moses along. And it seems like the very earliest humans offered sacrifices. So the fact that Job offered sacrifices for his children does not seem to agree with, necessarily prove that it was written after the time of the law. In fact, it does not indicate that he went to the tabernacle to offer sacrifices at all. So this would seem to be prior to the time of the tabernacle, because in the law, it was forbidden to offer sacrifices anywhere except at the tabernacle. So these considerations lead me to believe that it was written prior to the giving of the law. He is probably contemporary with some of the later patriarchs. As far as where he lived, it tells us right in the opening verse that there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. Unfortunately, we don't know where Uz was, but it does say that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil, and 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. And it says, also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Now it says he was one of the people of the East. East would be told, if this was written by a Jew, which seems likely, from the perspective of Israel, east of Israel, probably on the east side of the Jordan somewhere. Now, it's not likely that it means somewhere as far east as India or China or someplace like that. More likely, it just means those lands to the immediate east of Israel. Now, there is some suggestion that Job may have been a descendant of Esau and an Edomite. At least some of his counselors were. And there are some other suggestions about that which we may get to. But I'm getting ahead of myself there. What I wanted to suggest is that this early period of time, God had given no written revelation of his mind and his will. There had been no inspired word. Job and his friends could never have read any Bible because no Bible had been given. They were cast upon their general knowledge of God from deduction and from what their own hearts and their own consciences told them God must be like. Now, I don't know whether Job had personally known any revelations from God. He does speak later in his life, interestingly, if I could find it quickly here, when he is moaning over all that he has lost, he talks about the time when God's secret was in his tabernacle. It's in chapter 29 and verse 4. Job 29:4. Job is bemoaning the loss of former prosperity and former comforts and former favor that he used to experience. And he says, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent. I believe the King James says, when the secret of the Lord was in my tabernacle, or something like that. But the friendly counsel of God, it sounds as if he had had some revelation from God. God had talked to him in some form. He may indeed have been a prophet, as well as a great man of the East. But we don't know exactly what form or to what extent this communication with God had taken. And we know that there was no written revelation from God, but just as God had appeared to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, it may be that God had appeared to Job at some time, or that there was some means by which Job had received words from the Lord. At any rate, his friends and he had very limited knowledge of God, but they had some orthodox opinions. And according to the wisdom they had, they spoke. And much of what they spoke is very good wisdom. Unfortunately, it was inappropriate in the case of his friend's counsel. It was inappropriate to the case at hand. But we have in their saying some of the best samples of what we call wisdom literature. Proverbial sayings. Seemingly axiomatic insights into the way life is. Why Job is classed as the wisdom literature. It is a story, but since most of the material in the book of Job is not telling a story, we don't class it with the historical books. Did you notice? It's not placed along with the historical books, but it's placed as the beginning of the poetry books. The poetry books begin with Job, and then you've got Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. These books are called poetry books, as well as being wisdom literature. Don't be confused when I call them on one hand wisdom literature and on another hand poetry books. Some of them, all those books are poetry. Some of them are wisdom literature. Wisdom is sometimes written in the form of poetry. So is prophecy. When we study the prophets, we see that much of the prophecy was in the form of poetry. Poetry is just a literary genre or a literary style of writing. But wisdom literature speaks of the particular contents of what is being said. Job is both poetic and wisdom literature. Its style is poetic. Its content is that which is known as wisdom literature among the Jews. Okay? Now, I said that it probably takes place during the patriarchal period. It was written by a prophet, probably. Well, almost certainly. Job may have been that man who wrote it, though we don't know that that's true. Some feel that Moses may have written the story. There are some who would place it much later and would say the story was written in the days of Solomon or after. Now that's, in my opinion, much too late. But the reason they say that is because the style of literature, the wisdom literature that represents, was popular and common from the time of Solomon on. We know that from Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, which has much of the same style. Based on the style of literature, many people feel like it belongs to the later Solomonic period. But I personally don't think that's likely. It is not impossible that the story might have been written in the days of Solomon, even by Solomon. But that doesn't mean the events took place that late. In fact, since the speeches of the men in the story are put in poetic form, it is suggested that maybe those speeches are not word for word, the speeches as they were given. It may be that the story of Job and the basic content of what he and his counsel said was well known and passed down for generations, and at a later date, a writer who wished to put it in writing rephrased the speeches in poetic form because he wanted to write a book in poetic form. Some have felt like this must be the case because they thought, since the speeches were spontaneous on the part of Job and his friends, it seemed unlikely that they would spontaneously speak in poetry. And therefore, some have argued that the book must have been written at a later period by someone who rephrased the words of these people and recast them in a poetic form. Now that is a possibility, but it is also possible that these men did speak in poetic form. We know that they were noble men. They were men of a high caste in their society. Job certainly was, and his friends were no doubt of his caliber as well. And they were probably all wise men. They probably were accustomed to speaking proverbs and speaking these kinds of things. I mean, that's what the wise men spoke like. And we all know that they spent 7 days together without saying a word. It's possible that they prepared their statements during that period of time so that their speaking was not necessarily spontaneous. One for sure, they answer each other, but they don't seem to be hearing what each other is saying. It's almost like they're ignoring what the other party is saying because they know what they want to say. It could be that they prepared their speeches beforehand and very little that was said by any other parties entered into their consideration in doing their speeches. They did take 7 days of silence before speaking, and what they were doing during that 7 days, we don't know. They may have been preparing these speeches, in which case they could very well have cast them into a poetic form. It is also possible that, having thought through what they wanted to say, that they were capable of speaking in poetic form. There are people who are like sages, who somehow just, you know, begin to think in these ways of speaking. There are people who can spontaneously speak this way. You think it's strange to hear people speaking this way spontaneously, but maybe you wouldn't if you lived in the East in those days and were accustomed to the words of sages and wise men. At any rate, all I'm saying, we don't know for sure when it was written, who wrote it, whether the speeches were originally spoken in the form that we now see them, or whether they were later written down and rearranged into poetic form. None of those considerations are necessary for us to determine. But it is important for us to know that this story really happened. Because if it didn't, we are deprived of some very important information. For example, what happens in chapters 1 and 2? The conversations between God and Satan, I find to be some of the most important insights given anywhere in the Bible to explain why suffering comes upon people, to explain exactly how Satan relates with God. I mean, we learn some tremendous lessons in these first two chapters about Satan. And in the Old Testament, especially, and in the whole Bible too, there is very little teaching about Satan. We have comments about Satan here and there, but you don't really read anywhere of a systematic teaching in any passage of the Bible, a systematic teaching about Satan. If you want to understand about Satan, you have to take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, a little bit from there. And there's probably no passage in the entire Bible that tells us more in one place about the dealings of Satan than chapters 1 and 2 of Job. Apart from these chapters, we'd be totally perplexed in the Old Testament reading about an evil spirit from the Lord coming against Saul, or a lying spirit being sent from God to the mouths of Ahab's prophets, which we read about in 2 Kings, or 1 Kings chapter 22. When we have the information from Job chapters 1 and 2, it becomes much easier to understand what those expressions are talking about, it seems to me. I derive a great deal of my understanding of the spiritual realm and of what Satan is up to and how he works and what suffering is all about from the information given to me in Job chapters 1 and 2. I find them extremely valuable. However, if the story is not really written by a prophet, if the person was not privy to true information, if the story is a myth and a fable merely, then we are deprived of this valuable information. And it is information I would not like to be deprived of. Now the question is, therefore, is it a true story? The fact that it is written in poetry, much of it, and other factors that people suggest maybe it's not really a historic person that we're reading about, but rather maybe it's just sort of a parable about a guy, the quintessential righteous man who suffers. I mean, on the one hand, you've got Job described as the most perfect of all conceivable people. Blameless. God himself brags about how blameless the man is. I mean, if men say you're blameless, that's saying a lot. But if God says you're blameless, nothing more can be said in your favor than that. And yet we have God boasting about how Job is a man who fears God and eschews evil, blameless and perfect man. Now here's the man who's the essence of purity and righteousness, and yet the calamities that come upon him are of the most extreme imaginable types, one right after another. The story is almost, fictional in the way it sounds. I mean, one wave of bad news after another hits him in rapid succession. His camels are gone, his sheep are gone, his servants are gone, his family's gone, everyone's gone. He loses it all very suddenly, and then shortly after that his health is gone. All the most terrible things that can happen to a man, the loss of his possessions, of his loved ones, of his health, all pour upon him suddenly. I mean, one could argue, and some have, that this is the perfect fiction. You know, if you want to tell a story, a moral story, that has to do with righteous people suffering, you couldn't come up with a man more righteous than Job is described as being, or who suffers more than his sufferings are described to be. They're too perfect to be true. And the fact that he has, 7 sons and 3 daughters? This is the reverse. I mean, these ideal numbers. Look at the numbers here. It says in verse 2, 7 sons and 3 daughters. Then it's 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels. The 7s and the 3s being very common numbers in the scripture. Some say, well, this is not likely to be literal. This shows almost a numeric perfection that would be a symbol of a myth with a moral lesson attached to it or something like that. Anyway, this is the way people argue. And then along with that, the fact that you've got all these guys speaking in poetry instead of the way normal people speak. And then God thundering from heaven for 4 chapters near the end. A situation which apparently is witnessed by Job and his friends. A unique case in all of history. Except for at the Mount of Sinai, which was obviously a very important situation. I mean, you don't have very often in the scriptures that God pulls back the curtain of heaven and reveals himself and speaks audibly to a group of men. And when he does, it's some of the most, pivotal times in history, like the giving of the law at Sinai, or something like that, or the baptism of Jesus. So, I mean, these things have given some people the impression this must be mythical, this must not be true. But if it's not true, if this isn't a true story, then all this talk about Satan and God in heaven is not true either. In which case, we just have some Jewish guy's musings, some Jewish guy's opinions, somebody's guess about why Job suffered. I mean, why good men suffer, because Job would be seen as just the of all good men who suffer. Now, I don't accept that view. For one thing, because the Bible treats Job as a historical character elsewhere, both the Old Testament and in the New. If you look at Ezekiel chapter 14, Ezekiel 14, the prophet is saying that the city of Jerusalem has become so corrupt that God is not going to tolerate it. There's no saving it now. There's no hope for it at all. Whereas if there were 10 righteous found in Sodom, God would have spared the whole city. God will not spare Jerusalem no matter how many righteous are found in it or no matter how righteous they are. The righteous would just deliver themselves. They wouldn't deliver the city. And in Ezekiel 14 and verse 14, God says, though these 3 men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, that is in Jerusalem, they would deliver only themselves from righteousness, says the Lord God. In other words, they couldn't save the city. Verse 20 says exactly the same thing. So, Noah and Daniel and Job are mentioned as 3 examples of some of the most righteous people God could think of to give as examples of no matter how righteous a few people might be in the city, only they will be saved. They won't save the city. Noah, Daniel, and Job. Well, Noah is certainly a historical character. Jesus treated him as such. Daniel also. Jesus spoke of Daniel the prophet speaking certain things in the Olivet Discourse. He talked about the abomination of desolation written, spoken of by the prophet Daniel. So we know that Jesus affirmed that both Noah and Daniel were historical characters. And it would be very strange for God to try to list some righteous people and to list 2 historic characters and 1 mythical character among them. It seems clear that Ezekiel the prophet and his listeners understood Job to be just as much a historical character as Noah and Daniel were. And Daniel was living at the time when this was written. Daniel was Ezekiel's contemporary in Babylon. So there can be no question about his being a real person in the mind of the original readers. And so the impression is certainly given, and deliberately so, that Job was a real person, not just a mythical person. If you look over at James chapter 5, we have the New Testament also confirming the historicity of the man Job. James chapter 5, verses 10 and 11. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed if endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and have seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. Now, we won't read any further, but notice, James is seeking to inspire us to endure hardship. He says, think about the prophets and how much they endured for their testimony. That should help you be strong when you face trouble. Think about Job. You've heard of his patience. You've seen what the Lord did in the end. Sure, God put Job through hardships, but remember how well God treated him in the end. You've seen the end result. Now, James is talking as if Job is a real person. That what he suffered were real historic sufferings, and what God did to him in the end was a real historic thing. If not, then what comfort could it be to me while I'm suffering? To know that there was a mythical character who allegedly suffered certain things and was comforted. That wouldn't make me any, that would give me no inspiration or comfort to think of a non-historical event. To think of some tale where good triumphed in the end is no way to encourage me that that really happens in real life. The only way that James could be encouraging us to really be strong is if he understood, and we were to understand, that Job was a historical case. And we see how God treated him. Therefore, we should be encouraged because this happens in real life, because Job is a real life character. So, if we are to take the tone of Scripture, as opposed to the theories of men, we must say that Job is a historical character. And the story of God, yes?
I think I recall somewhere when we were going through a genealogy in Genesis, there was a form of, there was some thought that there was a form of Job.
Okay, I'm getting there. Okay. Yeah, there are some other considerations that would confirm that Job is a historical character. One of them is what John just mentioned, that there is, at least in the Septuagint version, which you know is the Jews' own translation of the Old Testament into Greek, in the Septuagint, Job is identified with one of Esau's descendants. Over in Genesis chapter 36, where we have the genealogy of Esau, Genesis 36:33, in talking about the kings of Edom, which were of course descended from Esau, Jacob's brother, and therefore related to the Jews remotely. Genesis 36:33 says, and when Bela died, Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his place. Now, Jobab is not necessarily the same name as Job, but it is thought by the translators of the Septuagint that that was Job. They may be wrong, but it is at least feasible. If he is, we know that Jobab was an Edomite, because that's what Genesis 36 talks about, the Edomite kings. And the Edomites had territory to the east of Israel, and we're told that Job was a great man of the east. In fact, we're told that Job was the greatest man of the east, which suggests that he may well have been the king or the chieftain of the Edomites in his day. It would seem strange for a citizen to be wealthier than the ruler, although maybe not impossible to imagine. It's very credible that he may have been this Jobab, one of the kings of the Edomites, one of the chieftains of the Edomite people. There's possible further confirmation of that in Genesis 36, because in Genesis 36:11, it says the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, and so forth. Now, Teman, one of Job's friends was a Temanite. In fact, his name was Eliphaz, the Temanite. Eliphaz is known to be a name current in Edomite genealogy, because we have Eliphaz there in chapter 36 of Genesis in verse 11. And we see that there was a man Teman of whom the Temanites would have come. And since one of Job's friends was Eliphaz the Temanite, not the same alphabet as mentioned here in Genesis, but nonetheless, those names are current in Edomite genealogy, then it would suggest the very real possibility that Job may have been an Edomite. It doesn't prove it, but it certainly adds some credence to the proposition. So it may be that Job was this man Jobab, spoken of in Genesis 36:33. Another consideration was that even as the book of Job tells us in verse 3 that he was the greatest of all the people in the East, because of his notoriety and greatness, his story seems to have spread, seems to have become common knowledge. It has been observed that in ancient literature of other nations besides Israel, in Babylonian literature, in Persian literature, and other ancient literature, there are stories that are quite clearly plagiarisms of the story of Job. As if all the people around about knew about this case and wanted to rewrite the story with the hero being one of their own ethnic peoples. There are a great number of Job-like legends in the ancient Near East literature. And those scholars of classical literature have identified several that have so many points in common with Job that they have even suggested that Job copied them. But since the book of Ezekiel and the book of James identify Job as a historic character, his story is not a plagiarism of some other book. Rather, they are plagiarisms of the book of Job. And his story happened so early on, and he was so famous, that apparently other nations knew about his story. And therefore were inspired by it to write fictions of their own that were very similar to it, which suggests again that he was a well-known historical character. One other consideration is that when it speaks about his friends, it gives their ethnic background, which would be unnecessary again if this was not a true story. If it was not historic, there would be no reason to give the ethnic background. Eliphaz is a Temanite, as I pointed out, which tells of his parentage. He's of Edomite background. Bildad is said to be a Shuahite. The Shuahites were descended from Abraham's son Shua, who was born of Keturah. After Sarah died, we read of Keturah being a concubine of Abram's, and he had 6 children by her. One was Shua, and the Shuahites, of which Bildad was one, came from him. Then Zophar is a Naamathite. Zophar, a Naamathite, Naama was in northern Arabia. And so we have, you know, geographical and ethnic designations for these people that would be totally unnecessary if the story was just trying to get across some moral lessons. It gives a historical flavor to the story, which is no doubt intended to be taken seriously. And so I would say that on the testimony of Scripture, as well as internal and extra evidences, we could say that Job certainly is an historic character, and I accept the story as taking place exactly as it occurred, with the possible exception that the speeches may have been reworded by a later inspired writer into poetic form. But I don't even think that's necessary to deduce. I think it's possible that the speeches were given exactly as they are in our Bible, and just to leave it at that. Now, there are some very big questions that the book of Job addresses, and it is a frustration to the reader that the answers aren't given in very clear terms. The great philosophical question that has plagued the minds of people for ages is, why do righteous people suffer? If there is a just God, why do the innocent suffer? Now, the fact that God would allow wicked people to suffer is not really difficult. We can understand justice to require punishment upon evil doing. And therefore, that we hear of evil people suffering doesn't plague our minds with confusion. We have it in our conscience. We know that it ought to be so, that wicked people ought to be repaid for the harms they do to other people. But why do righteous people suffer? Why do babies die? Why are babies born handicapped? Why do godly people suffer and wicked people seem to live prosperous lives? This is the question that Job and his counselors are debating over. Job's counselors believe the answer is that suffering is a judgment from God. That is, there is no such thing as suffering for righteousness' sake. This is also taught today in the Eastern religions. Karma and reincarnation teaches the same thing. If you're suffering, it's a judgment. It's a judgment for something you've done before. Now, of course, in Hinduism, the idea is that it's a judgment you on something you may have done earlier in this lifetime or maybe in a previous lifetime. But in any way, you don't suffer for nothing. You suffer because you did something wrong. And your suffering is a judgment. And all three of Job's friends, as they're called, with friends like that, you don't need too many detractors. But all three of his friends take the same philosophical position. Suffering is always punitive. It's always a judgment. And you can always tell that you've done something wrong by the fact that things aren't going well for you. And the corollary to that is that if things are going well for you, God's happy with you. Well, Job doesn't deny that at all. And in his debate with them, he points out frequently that, first of all, he isn't guilty of anything. Certainly he hasn't done anything so terrible that would justify these horrible sufferings upon him. Secondly, he knows of very wicked men who prosper and don't suffer. Therefore, reality does not seem to confirm the view of his friends. Job doesn't know exactly why he is suffering, but he knows that his friends are not, they don't have the answer to this difficult question. Elihu, the last man who speaks prior to God speaking, is an interesting character. He just kind of appears in chapter 32, isn't it? And, you don't even read of his having been present prior to that, but apparently he's been there for all the conversation and listening silently and finally speaks up and ventilates a lot of pent-up opinions that have been stored up while he's been listening to these people toying with these philosophical concepts without coming to any authoritative conclusions. His view seems to be that suffering is educational. Not necessarily a judgment, although it can be a judgment, but even if it is not a judgment, even if you've done nothing wrong, you can learn from suffering. But even that is not necessarily said to be the right answer to the question. In fact, sadly, the book does not ever tell us the right answer to the question. It doesn't write, finally, after all of this debate goes on, you have God pulls away the curtain and says, here I am, let me talk for a while. And he talks for four chapters, and that's when you say, now we're going to find out what this is all about. Now we're going to understand why Job is suffering. And God never tells. It's very frustrating. God never says, you're suffering because of this, and these guys were wrong, it's wrong, but here's what the truth of the matter is. God never does that. What God does do is basically argue, what business is it of yours what I do? Are you me? Are you God? Do you know everything? Is it necessary for you to know everything? Trust me. Period. He doesn't explain why Job is suffering. And it's it can be a bit frustrating. But we can, from the historic chapters in chapters 1 and 2, it would appear that we could deduce something like this. If we wanted to answer, why do the righteous suffer? Let me give you an answer that may be, I suppose, what the book of Job teaches. And that is that suffering is sometimes the price that righteous men have to pay for some higher good, which may be known only to God. Suffering is the price that righteous men may have to pay for some higher good known only to God. Now, think about it. That is certainly true in the book of Job. God had a reason for what he did, but he never told Job what it would be, nor did he tell Job's counselors, nor does he even tell us. We can only guess. And we can guess a little more intelligently than Job could because we have chapters 1 and 2. Which give us some information of what transpired beforehand. Job didn't even have that to help him out. But we can make an educated guess of why God may have done it, but even God doesn't tell us there. All we know is that it served God's higher purposes for some higher good. Job actually turned out better off in the end than he was before. And God blessed Job. God got what he wanted out of this deal, which was apparently his own glory. He was vindicated in the sight of the devil. And Job may never have learned what went on or why. All he would knew is that God knows what he's doing. And if God desires for righteous men to suffer and doesn't tell them why, well, then those men should just trust themselves to the mercy of God and to the wisdom of God and trust that God knows what he's doing. Maybe someday we'll understand why we suffered, maybe we won't. But is that important for us to know? It isn't. It shouldn't be. And that is what I believe the book of Job comes out of. One thing becomes clear in the story is that suffering on the part of a righteous man is a flattery. Because men do not put into the fire things made out of wood, hay, and stubble unless they hope to destroy them. But things of value that are put in the fire are only put in value if they are really like gold and precious silver. And things of real value can stand the fire. And the fact that God will subject a righteous person to the fire of trial suggests that God values him and knows that he's of the kind of stuff that can stand it. And Job even says something like that in chapter 23 and verse 10. Job chapter 23 and verse 10, he says, "For when he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold." Now, I'm not sure that Job fully understood this concept completely here, but he certainly knew he was being put through the fires of affliction. He knew he was going to retain his integrity. He knew he wasn't going to be destroyed by these things. And there's a sense in which a person could be flattered that God would allow him to suffer so much, because God won't allow you to endure more than you're able to. Won't allow you to be tempted above that which you're able to endure. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says. And therefore, if he allows you so much suffering, it's basically, "I've got a lot of confidence in you. I've got confidence that you can handle this. I've got confidence that you won't be destroyed by these flames. You're gold. You're not chaff." In that case, it's sort of a, like I said, it's a bit of a flattery. It's an honor to be entrusted to the fires by God, because it means you as imperishable gold that he would entrust to the flames. Now, there are three reasons I want to give you why Job and his friends were not able to understand what was going on. I think that there were three things that if they had known them, they may have been able to guess more intelligently what was going on. And we have access to these three factors that they didn't have. And this is why we're in a little better position to understand sufferings than they are. First of all, they did not understand the secret counsels of heaven. That is, they didn't know what was going on between Satan and God. This agreement that was being made that we read of in chapter 1 and 2. Job and his friends didn't know anything about that. We do, because we can read about it. But we still don't know much when we're suffering. We don't know what kind of conversation has gone on in heaven about this. All we can say is that there may be a similar situation in our case. But Job should have just trusted God even though he didn't know this. But that is one thing that really makes it difficult to understand why a righteous man is suffering at times, because nobody knows for sure exactly what God's counsels are, his secret counsels in heaven. Secondly, they didn't know the future outcome of God's providential dealings with Job. They didn't know what the future would hold, that God would turn things around and give Job twice as much as he had before. Now, all the while they were talking to Job, and Job was talking to them, these guys were saying, "Well, you must be, you know, on God's bad side because he's treating you bad." But the last chapter was not yet written. Job got restored. Things got better for him. And because no one knows the future, it's impossible to really say, you know, whether God's doing a merciful thing or not. Because it may be that after all of these things take place, that everyone will be in a better condition than before. Certainly we know from the New Testament that all things work together for good to those who love God and who are the called according to his purpose. In Psalm 119, it says in verse 75, well, even before that, pick up a little earlier, Psalm 119, verse 71, the psalmist said, "It is good for me that I've been afflicted, that I may learn your statutes." Down in verse 75, he says, "I know, O Lord, that your judgments are right, and that in faithfulness you have afflicted me." There's also another verse right in this section, which I don't remember off the top of my head, where he says, before I was afflicted, I went astray. Anyone see the verse there?
67.
Thank you. 67. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. Now notice how the psalmist views affliction. In verse 67, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but something good has happened as a result. Now I keep your word. The final end of my afflictions have been to my benefit and to my correction. In verse 71, he says, it's good for me that I have been afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. Again, there's a good thing that has come from those afflictions. You never know about it while it's happening. But what will happen in the end, no one can predict. Verse 75, I know, O Lord, that your judgments are right, and that in faithfulness you have afflicted me. So, if Job and his friends had known the future outcome and the benefits and the results that would come from his afflictions, their counsel may have had a different direction. So, first of all, they didn't know the secret counsels of heaven in the matter. Secondly, they didn't know the future providential dealings of God, in Job's case, what they'd be. And it becomes quite clear in their talks that they also have an inadequate knowledge of the rewards of the next life. Now, they perhaps can't be blamed for that, because in the Old Testament we have very little about the next life. We get far more information about eternal life and about heaven and hell and things like that in the New Testament. And Job and his friends didn't even have an Old Testament available to them. They didn't know very much about heaven or hell or heavenly rewards or hellish punishments. To them it seemed like if a man lived a righteous life and died in misery, justice had not been served. And there was something wrong with that. But we know that there are rewards beyond the grave, both for good and for evil, for the righteous and for the unrighteous. And that even if a man suffers all his life righteously, yet justice can be served by his being rewarded in the next life. And if a man prospers all his life in this life, though he be wicked, yet justice can be meted out to him in the next life through eternal punishments. So these three things are now information available to us that was not available to them. The secret counsels of heaven, of course, we don't always know what the secret counsel of heaven is even now when sufferings happen. But we know something like what happened in Job chapters 1 and 2 may be taking place even when our own case is such. They didn't know the secret counsels of heaven, first. Secondly, they didn't know the future providential dealings of God, what the last chapter would look like when God was finished with his dealings with Job. And thirdly, they had an inadequate knowledge of rewards of next life. They only knew about this life. All right? And they can't necessarily be blamed for any of those things. They didn't know those things. But they shouldn't have been presumptuous to think that they could come up with all the answers based on their limited knowledge. And so the book of Job gives us some very helpful insight into the prickly philosophical question of suffering. And it deals with this question of why do the righteous suffer? That's what the speech is all about. That's what the discourses of Job and his friends are all about. Why do the righteous suffer? But you know what? Chapter 1 and 2 address a different question. Not the question of why do the righteous suffer, but the question that is addressed in chapters 1 and 2 and raised in that chapter is, why do men serve God? In the book of Job, man's question is, why do the righteous suffer? But heaven's question is, why do righteous men serve God? And Satan suggests they serve God because God is good to them. And that if God allows them to suffer, they'll stop serving God. God believes otherwise. God believes there are men that will serve him and will remain true to him even if he does not bless them, even if he does not benefit them. And this is the debate in heaven. You see, there's a debate in heaven and a debate on earth in the book of Job. On earth, the debate is, why do righteous men suffer? In heaven, it's, why do righteous men serve God? And that's what we read out of chapters 1 and 2. And, you know, when I'm suffering, and I've suffered a few times, I haven't suffered very much in this life, but when I've suffered, I've often recalled this chapter, chapters 1 and 2, and said, okay, maybe that's what's happening right now. I don't know what's going on in heaven, but maybe the devil's saying, you know, let me afflict him, and he'll push you to your face. And there's sort of a contest going on in here in heaven. God's betting on me being faithful. The devil's betting on me being unfaithful. This trial is a test to see which is going to be right, God or the devil. And it makes me all the stronger in my resolve to not let the devil win that argument, but to be true and faithful and to be strong and trusting of God in those temptations, because that's why God allows these things to come to me, is so that I might be tested to see exactly which way I will respond. And the fact that God allows us to suffer is His way of saying, I'm going to put you on display. The devil's watching, the demons are watching, the angels are watching, I'm watching. We're putting you through the furnace. We're going to see whether you're made of gold or stubble. And God, in effect, is saying, I believe in you. I believe that you're gold. And that's why I'm putting you in the furnace. And I'm hoping you won't let me down. Because we've got a bet going here. God and the devil. And that's what we find in these chapters. Let's... We already read the first three verses that give some of the setting of Job. He had a lot of kids, 10 children, which was the mark of a blessed man in ancient societies. The man who had his quiver full of arrows like this was a blessed man. He also had a lot of possessions in rock, which was one of the main ways that people, one of the main forms in which people's prosperity was held. He also was great and wealthy in other respects and honorable and well known throughout his region. In fact, he was the greatest man of the East. In addition to all these earthly benefits, he was a spiritual man. In verse 1, we read that he was a blameless and upright man, one who feared God and shunned evil. Well, it tells something about his piety in verses 4 and following. It says, now his sons would go and feast in their houses, each one on his appointed day, and would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. Now, what appears to be said here is that every one of his seven sons on their birthday, that's what the appointed day would suggest to most readers, would have a feast. These would happen somewhat frequently. Since there were seven of them, there would be seven per year at least. It may be that it wasn't their birthday, but some other cause of celebration. At any rate, there was a lot of partying in that family. They had a lot of money. They probably had a lot of leisure. And so they'd have a lot of parties. Now, Job was not confident that his children were as godly as he was. But he was determined to cover for them. He knew that at a party, people sometimes drink too much. Sometimes they say evil things. Sometimes, you know, words come out of their mouths that they later read. And Job didn't know. Even if they didn't say bad things, who knows, their hearts may have cursed God. Now notice how concerned God is about this sin of cursing God. This is the very thing that Satan later said that Job would do. He told God, let me afflict him and he'll curse you to your face. Job was very against the idea of cursing God. Even if his sons cursed God in their hearts without uttering a word, he wanted to make sure that was covered. He knew what a great sin it was to be irreverent toward God. And so he, acting as it were, a family priest, offered sacrifices on behalf of his children. Presumably they attended these sacrifices. But whether they did or not, he was going to make sure that he, as the spiritual priest, the spiritual father, the spiritual shepherd of the home, was going to cover his family with his prayers and his sacrifices, his intercessions. And it's interesting that later on, when Satan is complaining to God, notice in verse 10, Satan is complaining that he has not been able to hurt Job. He says to God, have you not made a hedge around him, around his house, and around all that he has on every side? In other words, Satan is complaining, I can't touch him or his household or anything he has. God's protection was on Job because he was righteous, but also on his household, that is his children, and his possessions, because he vouched for the spiritual state of his household. Now, we are not told that his children were righteous. We're not told that they had personal faith. In fact, Job was not confident about them at all in that respect. He thought they might be subject to some excess, some impiety, some cursing God in their hearts on occasion. He was not sure at all they were righteous people, but he covered for them with his prayers and his sacrifices, and Satan couldn't get at them. As a father, this is a story that is very important to me, because I can't guarantee exactly how pious my children are going to be. I can teach them in the right way, but I can't determine whether they're going to embrace what I teach them or rebel against it. I may, obviously, if I do it in a poor way, I may encourage them to rebel against it. If I do it in a good way, it'll encourage them to embrace it. But finally, their decisions are their own. But it's nice for me to know that I can offer sacrifices. The prayers of the saints are the sacrifices that we offer. I can offer up sacrifices on behalf of my children and protect them from the affliction of Satan. That the hedge that God has around me also will extend around my household and all that I have. And Job had that experience because he interceded for his family, made sacrifices on behalf of his family. Well, verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless, upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" So Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power, or in your hand. Only do not lay a hand on his person." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now, this conversation is almost exactly like another conversation we read of in heaven in chapter 2. But we'll look at it in some detail right now, and we won't have to cover the same details when we encounter it in chapter 2. It says there was a time, a day, when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. Now, the sons of God is generally assumed, without question, refers to angels. There's a time later in the book of Job when God is speaking that talks about the sons of God sang for joy when God laid the foundations of the earth. If this is to be understood literally, and you know in poetic language sometimes it is not, but if it is taken literally, then the sons of God must have been existing before the foundation of the earth was laid, because they rejoiced to see it happen. Therefore, we are compelled, if that is taken literally, to say the sons of God must be supernatural beings, angels, probably. Now, we don't have any proof anywhere in the Bible that sons of God refers to angels, but it is a deduction that seems to make sense in the passage. Some have felt that we should not understand it so. Some have felt that the sons of God here refers to godly people, and would point out that in just about every place where the term children of God or sons of God is used in the Scripture, both Old and New Testament, the term usually can refer to and does refer to godly people. Now, if that is true, what would this mean? The sons of God were presenting themselves before the Lord. Well, that could be that they came to some sacred place to offer sacrifices and to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan was among them, as he is whenever godly people come together. Satan's always there to try to be the fly in the ointment and try to pervert their worship and accuse them and interrupt their relationship with God. Some understand it that way. I don't. I am of the opinion that sons of God here are supernatural beings, and we're not talking about some gathering on earth of sons of God to worship God, but rather that the angels come and present themselves before God. That is, they are accountable to God. And Satan, too, apparently is accountable to God, because he had to come and present himself to God. In the book of Zechariah, we see visions, especially the first vision in Zechariah chapter 1, about some horsemen who come and present themselves to the angel of the Lord and give a report of what's going on in the earth and of their activities. And these horsemen are generally understood to be angels. And so there seems to be the teaching of Scripture that the angels have to give an account from time to time to God. At least that's the picture I think we have here. The sons of God gathering periodically to report back. Now, one says, well, but then doesn't God already know what's going on? Does he need these people to come and report to him, these angels to come and report to him? Well, I don't deny that there's some anthropomorphic elements to this story. That is, that God is described as if he's a person with an arm and a hand and and you know, one who it's like he doesn't know certain things, and I mean, the language is definitely what we call anthropomorphic. That is to say, in the form of humans. The devil is described as if he's a human form. God is described that way. The sons of God, presumably that way. Many times, when the Bible is talking about spiritual things, it tells of things in a way that sounds, I guess, something we can relate to as human beings. It's common phenomenon in the Scripture. God sometimes speaks as if he's ignorant of certain things, which he certainly wasn't ignorant of. When God told Abram, he says, the cry about Sodom and Gomorrah is coming to my ears. I'm going down to see if it's as bad as I've heard. Well, certainly God was not unaware of how bad things were in Sodom and Gomorrah. That's an anthropomorphic way of speaking. God was acting, he was even appearing in the form of a man, apparently, to Abram, and talking as if he were a man. That may confuse us at times, but that's the opposite effect it's supposed to have. It's supposed to clarify things for us. God is not like a man. God does not have the limits of man. Yet, we don't know anything we can compare God to. That's why making images is wrong, because nothing we would make an image of God is a good comparison of what God really is like. There is nothing that can be compared to God. And therefore, when God tries to reveal what goes on in his mind, and what goes on in his dealings with man, or even what goes on in heaven, he tells the story in terms that are a little more easy for us to grasp, as in human terms. Now, whether it happened exactly like it's told here, or whether this is told more in an anthropomorphic way, so that we can appreciate this is like a conference in heaven, you know, the angels came back to report to God and so forth, if that may be an anthropomorphic way of simply telling us that the angelic beings are answerable to God and must give account of their activities to God and are responsible before God, then so be it. I don't know if it happens exactly this way or whether it's the way the literature is conveying it. But the idea certainly is this, that both Satan and the angels are answerable to God and must give account to God. And here, Satan presents himself and God says, well, where you been? He says, I've been walking to and fro on the earth, checking things out. And God says, oh, you probably noticed this guy, Job. You certainly would have noticed him. He stands out like a sore thumb. There's none like him in all the earth. He's uniquely righteous. He's just the kind of guy that you'd notice, Satan. He's just the kind of guy that would really be a pain in the neck to you. Because you haven't been able to pervert him. You haven't been able to hurt him in any way. You haven't been able to find any fault with him. He's blameless and upright. He fears God. He shuns evil. What do you think about that guy, Satan? Have you noticed him? And I think that God's needling Satan a little bit there, saying, you know, you haven't got everybody, do you? Righteous man. And Satan, of course, acts as if this is a special case, that he could have Job too anytime he wants, if only God would let him deal with Job as he wishes. Just let me afflict him. You put this hedge around him. How can I get at him? Now, what we see here, and it should be very encouraging to us, is that God has, or at least is capable of having, a hedge around the people that he wishes to protect from harm. No suffering can come into our lives unless God wills it, because God is capable of hindering it. God is capable of hedging it. Satan was complaining that he had no access to Job or his things. Job was a godly man. The devil had nothing in him. He had no grounds to accuse him. He had no means of afflicting him, because God willed it so. And Satan says, well, anybody would serve you whom you treated with such preferential treatment as you've treated Job. I mean, who wouldn't serve you? He's a mercenary, Job is. He knows that these benefits he's experiencing, well, you know, he wouldn't want to give those up by doing the wrong thing. But if you take those things away, you'll find that he has no more incentive to serve you. In fact, he'll prove himself to be as corrupt as anyone else. He'll curse you to your face. Now, John asked the question before class, or early in the class, I guess, in verse 11, he said, Satan said, now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. This I take to be a figure of speech. God, it was not God, but Satan, whose hand touched Job, because it says in verse 12, God says, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand," literally. The New King James says, "in your power." But basically, God allowed Satan's hand to intervene in the situation. Stretch out your hand may simply mean, you know, give me the go-ahead. Give me the go-ahead to do what I want to do. It's a figure of speech, and I don't think we should understand that it's God who afflicted Job, although there's a sense in which he did. He allowed Satan to afflict him. When it says that an evil spirit from the Lord came on Saul, or that a lying spirit was sent by God to the prophets of Ahab, it is to be understood that those spirits were not God's friends. But they had to get his permission to do what they did, and therefore their doing it was, in a sense, like God doing it, or God sending them. God had a use for them to do it. And we can assume that those are very rare cases, because if God doesn't want them to do that, they can't. In Job's case, his afflictions were very rare. It was a unique period in his life. Most of the time, there was a hedge about him. But Satan is saying, remove the hedge if you would, and I'll show you what I can make Job do. And so God says, well, I'll give you a chance. He's in your hand, only don't touch his person, don't touch his body. Initially, Satan only had the right to touch Job's possessions and not touch his body. In chapter 2, he asked further permission to afflict Job bodily. Well, let's just get to the end of this chapter. Verse 13, now there was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabians raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge. I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven. So they interpreted it, probably lightning. And burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands and raided the camels and took them away. Yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young men, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Now these were the afflictions that came on Job at the hands of Satan, which God allowed. We learn from this that Satan has power to act through wicked men, like the Sabians who came and ripped off Job and killed his servants, and the Chaldeans who did the same. He also has power over nature to some extent, if God permits. Now it is God, of course, ultimately, who has power over all things. But if God permits, the devil can use the forces of nature, fire from heaven or lightning, probably, wind, a strong wind that came up and knocked the house down on top of Job's kids. These are what would appear to be natural phenomena and devices of wicked men. But what the book of Job shows us is that these things are not simply that. Something else is behind them. The devil is behind these things when they come against us. But even behind it further is God. And that's what's very important for us to note. Because those who teach the Word of Faith doctrine use the book of Job poorly. It's a book that challenges their doctrine very strongly, because they believe that all negative things come from the devil and all positive things come from God. I will agree with that, but I might not agree with them on what things are negative and what things are positive. If we say suffering to be a positive thing, then I will agree. And that all that is negative is sin, then I would say, okay, all negative things are from the devil and all positive things are from God. But what they usually mean is things that are unpleasant come from the devil and things that are pleasant come from God. And therefore they have trouble with the book of Job, because you do find the devil at work in the book of Job, bringing these unpleasant things on him, but we also read very clearly of God's involvement. God releases him. And they usually try to find some reason why God allows it. They try to find some fault in Job's faith, because it is their doctrine that if you have enough faith, you will never suffer health, poor health, or poverty. And Job suffered both. His health was taken from him, and poverty was brought to him by the devil. But it is their view that if he had faith, it would not be so. Usually they'll turn our attention over to chapter 3. In verse 25, where Job, after he's lost everything, says, "For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dread has happened to me." They say, oh, you see? Before all these things happened, Job was living in fear. Job was living in dread. He had negative faith. He didn't have a positive confession. He didn't believe that he could hold on to these things. He was afraid it would happen, and it did. The fear came upon him. And they extrapolate from this statement a principle. Whatever you fear is going to happen to you. The problem with this, there's two problems with it. First of all, the things you fear usually don't happen to you. I mean, that's just a plain fact of your own personal history. You have feared very many things that never happened. That's one of the things that makes worrying so foolish and wasteful. Because you expend so much emotional energy worrying about things which never were a real danger in the first place. They never materialized. Now, some of the things you worry about happen, but it cannot be proven scripturally that they happen because you worry about them. If worrying about something or fearing something brought it upon you, then that, you would have had a far greater number of things come against you than you have, because you have worried about things and feared things that didn't happen. And therefore, you can't teach such a doctrine from the scripture. Furthermore, Job may say nothing more than, "The thing that has happened to me is one of the most fearful things I can imagine. The loss of my children, the loss of my possessions, sure. The thing I feared, not the thing I desired, has happened." But that doesn't mean that it happened because he feared it. Any man at moments may ponder the potential loss of his family or of his goods and may shiver a little bit at the thought. But that doesn't mean that Job was living in constant worry about this. His statements do not need to be construed that way. But the most important thing to observe is that they are testifying against God when they say that Job suffered because of something he did wrong. Because the Bible itself says, and God himself says of Job, he was a blameless and upright man. God found no fault in him. Blameless means he can't be blamed for lack of faith or anything else. Lack of faith is a sin. God didn't say, "Okay, Satan, because he has lack of faith, I'm going to let you do these things to him." He said, no, he's a blameless man. Can't find any fault with him. He's upright. Not a thing can be said against him. He fears God. He eschews evil. That's good. And in saying that Job suffered because of some defect on his part, which is what the Word of Faith people have to say to maintain their doctrine, because they believe that no one suffers except by defect in one's own faith, is to argue against God, who said there were no defects in Job. And one of the things that the first two chapters in Job are trying to point out very clearly is that Job did not suffer because of any personal defect, but because of some arrangement that God and Satan made. And I remember first hearing this story when I was a kid. I said to my dad, why did God fall for that line from Satan? Why did God let that happen? And my dad said, I don't know. And I suppose that's a wise answer. But there is this, however, and that is that God's honor was at stake. Satan was suggesting that a man wouldn't serve God, that God was not lovable enough in himself to be served without reference to his blessings. And if it could be shown that there was a man who would serve God without any blessings from God, but just out of love and loyalty for God himself, it would affirm that God had those who knew him to be good, despite what he did to them, and would therefore bring honor to God. And God would be honored also by the faith of Job and also by blessing Job in the end. Anyway, that may not be the whole answer of why God did it, but we certainly know that it wasn't because of anything Job did wrong. And it's a great mistake for people to say it was. In fact, in verse 20 it says, "Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground in worship." The tearing of his robe and shaving his head were signs of great mourning. He had just heard of the death of his family, of loss of all his possession and his servants, and he takes on the garb and the appearance of a mourner, but he worships God. He doesn't curse God. The very thing Satan said he'll do, he'll curse you to his face. Wrong. He fell to his face and he worshiped God. And he said, naked I came out of my mother's womb, that is, without owning any possessions, even clothing, and naked shall I return there. I didn't have anything when I came, I won't have anything when I leave. And that's what also the Apostle Paul says in different words over in, I think it's in 1 Timothy chapter 6. He says, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we'll take nothing out of it with us. That's exactly what Job was saying. I didn't bring anything into the world with me. I naked, didn't even have a scrap of clothes to my name, and that's apparently how I'm going to go out of this life too. And the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now, Job says the Lord gave and the Lord took away. He doesn't say the Lord gave and the devil took away, although there's a sense in which that would be true. But he said the Lord gave and the Lord took away, and that too is true. Now, again, the word of faith people would say, no, Job was mistaken here, accusing God. It's one of Kenneth Hagin's books is called Don't Blame God. And the word of faith people would say that Job was blaming God for his problems. God took it away. And they say he didn't know. It was really the devil who did it. But there's a sense in which it really was God who did it, and the Bible does not accuse Job of saying the wrong thing. It's, in fact, the opposite is true. In verse 22 it says, in all this, Job did not sin, nor charge God wrongly or with wrong. In other words, the commentary on Job's statement is, he said the right thing. He didn't mistakenly attribute something to God that God didn't do. He didn't blame God wrongly. Even though he said the Lord gave, the Lord took away, that's the right thing to say. He didn't sin. He didn't blame God with things wrongly. And therefore we can see that there's no way to harmonize the word of faith doctrine with the narrative we have before us. And that's why they spend a lot of time talking about this, trying to twist it around and manipulate it. But it's quite clear if you just take it at face value. It teaches that some people suffer horrible things, have done nothing wrong to deserve